Listen. This is the Black Country Blokes chewing the fat about everything that is mental health. Now, we're not experts, but we are experienced, so we're encouraging you to share your experience because every experience is worth sharing, so please be part of the conversation.
Listen.
Abinyat, it's the Black Country Blokes chewing the fat here with me, Kev Dillon, Lee Cabin, and our very special guest today is John Mason.
Mansell.
Ah, blimey. It'd be nice to have a week where I actually get someone's name right. Mansell, sorry. And he's ex-booze hound. And John, thank you ever so much, brother, for coming on.
No, it's great. It's my pleasure.
Sorry about getting your name wrong.
That's all right. I've been called worse. So.
And John's had his demons with addiction, alcoholism, but we'll be talking about that after our news. But we're going to start as we always do, like we do, our support group. So, Lee, now something positive that's happened this week.
You couldn't get a John first with that, could you? It's been a pretty tough day, to be fair, Kev, but positive. So, you know what? I think it's a simple one this morning that we've made it to nearly the end of the day.
Yeah.
That's a positive.
And sometimes nothing
major's happened.
And sometimes it is sad, you know, we have to remind ourselves that we have survived another day. And sometimes we're in our darkest points. We honestly don't feel like we're going to see the end of the day. Positive for me. I've had some good news in a few weeks, but I'm not going to quite tell you what it is yet. But yeah, I've got two boxers, Tom Jones and Will Wilson, through to the Midlands final in boxing. And Paige Ford is through to the semi-final, into the national either quarter or semi-finals. So overall, the boxing's doing brilliant. John, anything positive?
I suppose the one that springs to mind at the moment is being here talking to you guys.
Well, that's the first person who's done that, haven't they?
And quite frankly, felt lovely.
Yeah, it's about
so
time, isn't
that's
it?
That's it. I'll try and keep my nose less brown as we move forward. But I think, as Lee just said, you know, it is about, you know, positives happen every day. It's how you react to them and what you do. Positives, I've been to the gym a couple of times this week and haven't really wanted to. You know, I've had a few moments where I could feel my mental health was falling down a little bit, but I picked myself up and moved on. So it's you can always find the positive in any situation.
And I think when you've been in the mill, one good thing about suffering before is you can see the signs of you're about to have a wobble.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that I bang on about an awful lot these days. It's about understanding yourself and how your illness affects you. So one of my things that comes in all the time, tiredness is my enemy.
Yeah.
If I start getting tired, I know things are going to start going wrong. If I get a little bit upset with someone pulls out of me in a car, that is a sign that there's something not quite right. So you just take a step back and reassess it and go again.
And I'd say, I think that comes with age, doesn't it?
Experience.
It's great to read a book and go, oh, that's how it should feel. But when you know yourself by experiencing it, Kate, I need to lie down. I'm tired. No, we've got to go out. We've got to have a day out. And you push through tired, and before you know it, you react, and instead of it being a calculated decision to snipe or to walk away, when you're tired, you react, and you react normally in a manner that isn't yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, I've had myself a little power nap before I came out here today, and the part of the reason for that is that I know that doing stuff like this, although it's great to do, it can have a negative effect on me the next day. So I get a bit of rest before I come out. And again, with regard to the reacting, I think there's an awful lot in that. One of the things that I've said all the time is I don't allow other people to affect my mental health issues. It's not really what they've said or what they've done. The negativity comes from the way I react. So if I react in a negative way, that's my problem. That's not your, you know, it's not someone else's. So you do have to know yourself and learn about yourself.
Well, you talk a lot about that, Lee, don't you? Because I can get very fired up with people and think, how dare he? Or hasn't he considered my feelings? And how? Yeah, and Lee, I'll just go, who cares? And I go, well, and I go, well, Kev,
it's not just that, Kev. You disturb your own peace for someone who probably doesn't give it a second thought after it's happened. Like someone cutting you up. You know, you can stand there getting angry all you like. That bloke's probably gone down the road and forgot about it within 30 seconds. So why are you disturbing yourself? Why are you putting yourself in a bad mood for the sake of something that really doesn't matter and that the other person's totally forgot about?
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. You know, if you carry these arguments on or you carry this upset on, all you're doing is hurting yourself and damaging yourself. And the, let's say, perhaps moron who's just driven down the road, he doesn't give a, you know, he couldn't care less. It doesn't even register with him. So you just have to, you know, manage your own reactions. What's the point in getting upset? It's only going to upset you, isn't it?
But once again, that comes with age and experience, isn't it? Because only just meeting John, but I used to lose weeks upon weeks of sleep over that. You know, oh, well, and then you bump into him. And I always laugh about this and say, I have a row with Jeff, and I go, next time I see him, he's going to do this, and he's going to do that, and I'll go for 100 arguments. He walks past and goes, as your daughter, and I go, you are. And I'm thinking, I've planned every argument apart from, as your daughter, I go, she's all right, Jeff. And he walks past, and a lot of times we plan things that never happen. And our brains, I was talking to Emily from Gravy Banana, and she was saying, our brains don't know that's fictional. So every argument, every fight, every scenario, my brain has had to go through it, and it doesn't know what's fake and what's real. So that's why you're tired all the time.
Yeah, well, absolutely it is. It's, you know, you go over all the different ways you could have dealt with that, and well, next time he says that, I'm going to say this. But, you know, realistically, what's the point? You know, at the end of the day, you know, if, again, one of the things I say quite a lot, if, you know, if we got upset every time we bumped into a moron, you'd spend your whole life upset. If they've got a problem, walk away. You know, you're just damaging yourself. You're just putting yourself through stuff that you don't need to. Just, it happens. Move on. I mean, you know, as I talked about being cut up earlier, I know I've cut people up. I didn't do it on purpose. So, you know, they didn't do it on purpose. It's an accident. Move on.
And I think that is the key with life. A lot of stuff that happens to us isn't deliberate. We just happen to be in the crossfire of someone else's action. And I think when you can take that a breath, it doesn't matter.
It's that thing, isn't it? Count to 10. I would say I step back. One of the hashtags I use on Twitter a lot is pick your battles. You know, what's the point in wasting your energy on something that is pointless when you might need that energy later on in the day for something that's useful? So pick your battles, move on.
And nothing ever comes good out of anger, does it really? I think back through my life, any time I've got angry, it's not really helped anything at all.
No, and I think I mentioned earlier before we started, you know, it's tired is my enemy. If I do get a little bit ratty or a little bit aggressive, I know there's something wrong, so I have to step back, because all that anger's going to do is make the day a bad day. There's no point in that. You know, life can throw a lot of stuff at you without you throwing extra stuff at you yourself as well. So you have to try and be a little bit laid back about it. Otherwise, you just get wound up with everything.
Well, through many times going to counselling and all this, and anger isn't a pure emotion, like love is a pure emotion, like laughter is a pure emotion, you find something funny. Anger is a combination of frustration, embarrassment, humiliation. A lot of times we get angry is to protect ourselves from feeling one of those emotions. And when you strip it down and go, well, why am I angry? Because he or she has made me feel like this. You break it down and you go, I haven't got to protect myself from it. It's all right to feel that way. But by reacting to it in an aggressive manner, 9 times out of 10, you're making yourself look like the bad man or woman.
Yeah, and again, the strange thing, I mean, again, with your boxing background, you will know that, you know, it's about channeling that anger, isn't it? Yeah. If you get angry in a boxing ring, you're going to probably get knocked out, aren't you?
Yeah, it's been mistakes.
But I actually think if you channel anger in the right way, it can actually be quite a positive emotion. I know when I started the blogs and stuff, that was done out of anger. And for a while I was very angry, and I channeled it probably in the wrong way. But sometimes it's a great emotion to give you a kick up the backside. You know, you can be angry with yourself for allowing your issues to get on top of yourself. And when you do get angry with yourself, you think, well, I've got to do something about it. So if you channel anger in the right way, it can be a good thing. But usually, I think nine times out of ten, it's a bad thing. But it can be useful sometimes.
It's like nerves, isn't it? Nerves, when they... I've spent my whole life being frightened and nervous, but it's pushed me through the door. It's made me do it. But it's when it becomes crippling, isn't it? So it's using these emotions in what they're good for.
You hear the actors and band members and stuff like that talk about the fact that if they weren't nervous, there's something wrong. You know, I think nerves push you through. It's a fight or flight thing, isn't it? You know, it's how it runs, and it's again with any emotion, it doesn't matter whether it's anger, sadness, nervousness or whatever. It's not what's happening. It's how you react to that makes it worthwhile. So I was a little bit nervous about coming here today, but I knew I wanted to do it, you know, and it drives you forward, doesn't it? Adrenaline drives you forward.
And I think because we're human beings.
Just about.
Just about. But we should be happy, we should be sad, we should be angry, we should be loving, we should be... And it's only when it becomes very extreme, like my cat has a mess on the carpet, I'm sad, I'm angry, the cat still has had a mess on the carpet. That's natural. You drop your sausage, as we always laugh about, Dan. You drop your sausage from the chip shop, you're sad, you're angry. It's when it's extreme, you know, extreme sadness, extreme happiness, and that's when it becomes the murky water of mental health, isn't it? But as a human being, we should have highs and lows.
You naturally have highs and lows just in life in general, don't you? It's you know, I think with mental health and I like to, I think there's only two types of people in the world, and there's mentalists, which are us, not very politically correct, but never mind, and there's normals, and there's only one difference between the mentalists and the normals, and it's by degree. So a normal would get upset by someone pulling out on them, but 10 seconds later they couldn't care less. When you're a mentalist and you're in a bit of a bad place, it starts to really start ticking around in your head, and you just make it worse and worse and worse, and you spiral it out of control, you know. And it's that straw that break the camel's back, in it. You know, the other day I knocked over nearly half a pint of Diet Pepsi all over the floor, and I just nearly lost the plot. It doesn't hurt anything, but it's just, you just got to deal with them as they come rather than allowing them to override you.
And sometimes it changed from day to day. The old saying, you got out the wrong side of bed. Some days you're bulletproof, you know, it doesn't matter. Other days you're that fragile, maybe it's because you haven't slept or whatever. You spill your Coke or your cat messes or whatever, and it is the end of the world.
It is, and again, I suppose that's, you know, again, if it I think in normal life as well as mental health illness, you know, life, you do react in different ways on different days, you know. And I've always sort of said, you know, with mental health issues, when people ask you questions, the answer to that question could be different at 11:30, 2:00, 7:30. It's where you are at that point. But I think, yeah, it is the highs and lows and the extremes that I think we have to try and manage what we do to make sure that we don't have those highs and lows. But sometimes there's absolutely nothing you can do. The lows there or the highs there for no reason whatsoever.
And it's just a frame of mind that you happen to be in at that time. And if it happened yesterday or before, and it's happened today. And sometimes, as we said, with education of ourselves, learning sometimes to be aware it's about to happen.
Yep.
So put your head down, do your meditation, do whatever your medicine is for making yourself feel better. And it's like learning how to do the press-ups for when you need them. You know what I mean? It's if you do the mind exercise, when I actually need to do it, I am strong enough to do it. But there's no point when I'm having a wobble going, oh, blooming neck, what did I have to do? We have to set the movement in motion by having the protocol there for when I need it.
Yeah, again, it's that sort of thing, because, again, with emotions, whether they're real, whether they're not real, whether they're caused by mental health, whether they're caused by something else. You never really know how you're going to react to them, and again, I don't like the phrase coping mechanisms. It annoys me, but you know, these coping mechanisms that you have, and they change the linear. You know, they move about. So if one thing doesn't work, try another thing. You know, it's but sometimes you are just simply out of control. And yeah, there's I had a moment the other day and I came up with a new phrase. I had an internal tantrum.
Yeah.
I was trying to do two or three things at once and then my mind just went, aha, yeah, you know, and I just lost it. And I thought, right, go out, get out. And then a great thing happened then. I had to go and stay with my nephew for an hour. So from a really negative thing, I got a text, brilliant, going down to see my nephew. So you just have to react to what's going on when it happens, and don't let it, you know, don't beat yourself up, don't let it grind you down.
Well, you say that sometimes, Lee, don't you? Like,
but that's the key in that situation, isn't it? Because you could have gone and saw your nephew, still in that frame of mind, that same mood, and then that would have wrecked your visit with your nephew.
Yeah.
So stopping, just going, okay, I'm going to park that over there now. Let's go and have some fun over here, and then I'll deal with that when I come back.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. And that's the right way of doing it. It's not always possible. That is the right way of doing it. Don't let it spoil the rest of your day.
But absolutely, you know. Again, you know, some days there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. You're just going to be in a bad mood. I call myself, I'm grumpy a lot. You're just in a bad mood, and you just got to do what you can. You know, again, you said earlier, you know, with regard to your positives, you've made it through another day, and that's all you can do sometimes. You know, I always, you know, you pat yourself on the back because you've managed to do a bit of washing up and you put the bins out, but sometimes that's all you can manage.
You got up and brushed your teeth.
Yeah,
You know, sometimes you have to celebrate even those little things, don't you? To some people, these just nothing, but to you on that day, it's really important that you've managed to get yourself out of bed.
I think that's interesting as well, because again, obviously with three blokes sitting here talking about this, you know, I would imagine there's an awful lot of blokes out there thinking, what the hell are they on about, you know what I mean? But that's the reality of life, that's the reality of the way we live, you know, and nothing that anybody says, you can't discount anything that they're saying, because that's how they're feeling at the time. And if that's how they're feeling at the time, then you have to find a way to work through it.
And I can guarantee those people who don't suffer with mental health problems will come into contact, whether it be close family or friends that do. So us having a conversation, hopefully they get a bit more of an understanding that this happens, this is why we feel this way at this point, you know, this is what we do to help. Because I think, because it's not a broken leg, you can't see it, it's, you know, it's always going to have that stigma. So hopefully just having a conversation, that breaks it down. Because everyone is, at some point, if you don't suffer with mental health, you will be around someone who does.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the major things that when I was invited to do this, I really wanted to do, because it's three blokes talking about mental health. You know, we've already said some things that, you know, people could think, you know, what a wuss. But, you know, it's reality. And you know, a lot of the time, the reason I started the blogs and the vlogs and I've done all the talks over the years is that I'm a, you know, average-looking bloke. I don't look weird, for want of a better phrase. And I just want people to understand that it's okay to talk, you know, have mental health issues.
Well, this is why we started, and it's been amazing for the last 2 years. How many blokes, because you were saying, like, how many blokes are there thinking, listen to him, three blokes. But in our experience, how many blokes are going, blimey, Kev, I've never heard anyone else talk about having a wobble. And it's been refreshing to them thinking, because I always say this on every show, the best friend of any mental health is loneliness. When you feel like you are the only one, and I must be weak because I keep having a cry, or I must be weak because I'm frightened, or I must be weak because I can't even blooming get up and brush my teeth.
Yeah.
What kind of a man am I?
Yeah.
And when you start talking and blokes go, me too. Some days I don't even get out of my dressing gown.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but you have to have that start that conversation. And again, you know, it's, it is, it's, I mean, again, don't want to bring down the conversation at the moment, but we all know that there's a hell of a lot of blokes out there that go through horrendous times, but they have to be the big brave man. Mm-hmm. And be strong. Well, I would suggest that you're stronger if you strap on a pair and actually find a way of talking about it. And I've certainly found the more I've spoken about it, rather than the way I thought people would respect me less, people respect me more for being, well, people say brave. I don't buy into that because I feel that's sort of buying into the stigma, but I chose to do this. You guys have chose to do this. We're doing it for a reason. We want to try and help other people break that cycle that ultimately will destroy them.
And by being honest, it's really, I mean, it saved my life and yours, don't it, Lee? Because I haven't got to hide from it anymore. Like, from admitting to the world that I've got bad eyes, you know. And you said, blooming heck, you told me you got bad eyes, you didn't realise. But I always thought, like, I had my depression, my anxiety, because I was brave. I've always been brave. Looniest bloke in the room, but I wasn't confident.
Yeah.
But people mistook the two. Oh, you must be confident for doing what you do. No, I was a frightened little child.
Yeah.
But the fear made me do it. But for the first time in all my years, I'm confident now because, yeah, I get upset. I don't really give a monkey's if I say I've had a cry, if I'm having a wobble, if I had a panic attack, if I... And I'm not brave. Brave is in with my emotions now. I'm just honest.
They'd say, isn't it, honest is the best policy. But, I mean, I don't know if that's always true, to be fair, when you've spent many years drinking. But honesty is the best policy. I was talking to somebody the other day just about to go back to work, and she wondered whether she should be a bit more honest about, you know, what she's going through. And I sort of said to her, you don't have to be 100% honest with what's going through it, but I think you'll get more support if you just say, look, I've had a bit of a wobble, I needed to take some time. You know, because the problem is, when you hide away from it all the time, then you have to run two people at the same time. You've got this face on that you've already got on. So for me, people with mental health issues, they get tired because an 8-hour day is a 16-hour day, because you're running two people at the same time, which is what that tattoo on my arm's about. You got like a normal face there, and then behind you can see the screaming. So she's putting a brave face on there, but in actual fact she's going through pain behind there. And I think that's what a lot of us do. We waste our energy putting on these fronts. That
plus I think the talking about it, like, since I've been talking about it, it also releases you from it, doesn't it? You know, we do this to help other people, without doubt, but there's also no doubt about it that it helps us.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd recommend anyone to go out there and start speaking about it. The more we do break it down, the more we have these conversations, the happier everyone will be.
And sometimes, you know, there are plonkers, to put it politely.
Yeah.
And if I'm in a supermarket, do I walk up to the first person pushing the trolley and go, I'm having a wobble, you know? Because you might look at me thinking, what on earth is this weirdo on about?
Yeah.
It's picking the people, picking the time. It takes trust. It takes intimacy. But once you start being more honest, the person who's told, if not at that time, first of all, go, you look better, our son, or our girl, or he goes, you look like you've gained, you know, you've lost 5 years, and you just look better. And that's from depression. We've had people who've been sexually abused, and drug addicts, alcoholics, prisoners. We've had everyone on over the 2 years, haven't we, Lee? And everyone says, when I owned up to the fact, it made me feel better, because then I could own it, accept it, and move on from it.
Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, I had my mental breakdown in 2013. I've got some dates tattooed on me here, and it's my birth date. It's 1973 when I was born, whenever I tell the story. And then 2003 when I ended up in the booze clinic and I was reborn. And 2013 was when I had my mental breakdown. And people always go, oh. But it's not, in a way, but having my mental breakdown was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it finally meant I had to deal with the severity of how ill I was, And in doing that, it gave me a chance to start living life again. And again, the honesty is, you know, I regularly introduce myself. So I'm John, also known as ex-Boozan. I'm a mentally ill retired alcoholic. You know, I don't care. And I've had people who, you know, have given me abuse and say, you know, just pull yourself together. I couldn't care less what they think about me, you know, but me talking about it openly and honestly, it allows other people to talk about it as well. And that's the really important thing of what you guys do and what I've tried to do over the last few years.
But don't that comment when people say, pull yourself together, all, oh, for God's sake, just stop. And with it, you're an alky, a druggie, an overeater, an undereater, a self-harmer, and it's, oh, for God's sake, just stop it.
Yeah.
If it was that blooming easy, it wouldn't be a problem. If it was that easy, you'd go, oh, thank God I never thought about it,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's never easy, is it, you know, at the end of the day? And quite often, the other thing is as well, with your alcoholism or addiction or mental health or whatever it is, we've spent many, many years getting to that point. So if we then decide we want to fix it, it's obvious that it's not going to happen overnight. You've got to spend a lot of time working on the bad lessons that you've learned, the bad behaviour that you've done in the past, to change and reprogram your own mind. You know, it's taken us a long time to get in the state that we're in. So we've got to put in the effort to get to the state, get out of that state.
It's also, I was actually listening to a podcast the other day, and it's amazing what you get. So it's called the 7-generation rule, and they had people in the Civil War who had never who had gone through the Civil War, passed away, but the families had carried on, and the family, you know, going down the line 7 generations, still didn't do as well because of that Civil War. Basically, it was inbred into your DNA, that trauma. And it's absolutely fascinating that it's coming back from right, you know, 7 generations. That's a long time to be carrying around a trauma and it be embedded in your DNA.
What do you think, like, because, like, the woman lost her husband, so she suffered and had sad kids, or what
do
you think?
Like, I'm no expert on it. It was something I'd listen to, but
what's
that, sorry?
You know, listen to it very hard.
But no, it could be that you've been through the war,
yeah,
and just the trauma of it, or the same with the world wars, you know, people put in concentration camps and things. That's got to, that basically, the knock-on effect to that is not just that person and the family after. It goes on for 7 generations.
Even to when you're having a baby, you know, just on that subject, like, they say, like, if your wife has a happy pregnancy and she's laughing all the time, you have, like, happy babies. And maybe it goes down to that, you know, like, because the baby's being cooked in the mummy's tummy and
influences. I think it's more to do with it's inbred in your DNA to be more protective because you've had past trauma. So it just goes on to the next people.
Just a lot to get someone on if anyone's listening and you know more about that because, you know. But isn't it amazing what can affect us? Like, I was watching a programme the other day, Good Morning Britain or whatever it was, and it was saying about artificial food and colourings. And it showed this picture of the brain, and it was linking different parts of the brain that had never been linked up before. And I thought, well, is that something to do with what's going on now?
It kind of all makes sense, though, doesn't it? Because you think about personalities. A lot of your personality comes from your parents, which comes from parents. You know, it all kind of links and comes back in.
It's like a butterfly effect. Everything has an effect on something else, doesn't it?
When there's one action, there's always a reaction. And it passes on. And again, you know, if we're talking about trauma, I mean, you only got to think about what we've been going through for the last 18 months, you know, with regard to how long that trauma with regard to COVID is going to pass us on. And it does, I think, around, you know, if you've got both parents that suffer with anxiety and depression, it's almost as for the child when they're growing up, it's almost as if that's the normality and they expect to a certain extent to be that way themselves. And I think sometimes somebody has to put that extra effort in to break out of that mould. you know, with regard to, you know, you mentioned earlier quickly, you know, with regard to people who have been, you know, sexually abused and things like that, and how we know it passes on through family to family, and you know, through the generations, and it often takes a very, very brave, strong person to break that connection, to make things better for the rest of the family moving forward.
You're exactly right. We had Paul on. I can't remember his second name now, but he
We don't know it at the time, did
no,
we?
No. But he writ a book with his daughter called The Struggle Continues. And basically, he had complex PTSD.
CPTSD,
isn't he? Yeah. That's what I said, complex, oh, Kevin. Yeah. Don't confuse me. Yeah, the C stands for complex. Yeah, you've lost my train of thought now. but he had that. But when he was speaking to his therapist at the end, he didn't, at the time, until he spoke to his therapist, he thought his upbringing, because a lot of it came from his upbringing, he thought his upbringing was absolutely normal. And it wasn't until that point that he stopped. No, that's not normal. That's not normal behaviour. That's not what your parents should be doing, you know.
But I think you could come across. I've spoken to a number of guys and they've been through similar things, and you know, it is. I mean, at the end of the day, a child doesn't know anything else, do they? However unpleasant things are, whether it's physical or mental abuse or whatever, a child doesn't know anything else. So it probably doesn't seem weird at the time. And one of the guys that I used to do some stuff with, he completely sort of blocked out his childhood and then somehow remembered something about it and then completely broke down when all the memories came back. But at the time, you don't know any different, do you? And, you know, that's when the damage is done. But it takes really, really brave people to say they've been through this, say they're going through this, and that they need some support to break that pattern. And trauma is catching, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it just is, because you know, when you're in the room with someone who's sad, you can feel sad. It's passing on. It's like a yawn, isn't it? Someone yawns, someone else yawns. But again, it's about how you react to that and whether you can put in the effort to break that pattern.
And as you said, like, when it's learned behaviour, you don't know that you shouldn't be reacting to it until you get a bit older. And if you only see alcohol as being daddy's thing, or drugs or abuse or sexual abuse or whatever it is, if that's just normal, you react to as you react to having a kiss and a cuddle off your mum.
Mm-hmm.
If that's how love is, that is how love is, and that's how, you know, you react to it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you know, I think fortunately, I mean, there's bad stuff, isn't there, obviously, on social media. But I think, you know, I think our kids these days learn earlier that what's right and what's wrong, because of, you know, we talk about it, you know, it's like everything else, we talk about things a lot more openly these days, and for the reason is because we want to make sure they can make changes. It's again, you know, it's not what happens to you, it's how you react to that. And you see an awful lot of people. I think you know, on Tuesday you had John Reed on, and his mate from prison, you know, it's he's gone through that process, he's done whatever he's done to, you know, to, he's gone down the bad way, but then he's decided to change that, and then he goes forward and helps other people understand that once you get into that world, it's really hard to get out of. So you need people to talk about it so you can understand that where you're going is a bad thing.
And I think it needs people with experience to talk about it. You know, there's no good me going into prison, never been in prison in my life, and talking to a load of prisoners and telling them how to not to get into trouble. It's, you know, you need someone who's trod that path, for those other people to then have a bit of respect and listen.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually don't like the term expert by experience, because it's an NHS term, so I call myself a life experience warrior. And it is, because when you're having these conversations with people, you know, you can talk about stuff that's happened to you and they'll go, that attack thing happened to me. What did you do? And you start to understand, and that's when you start to break down that isolation of it only happening to me. You know, it's when you start to realise that other people have been through exactly the same thing, and got through it. You know, it you start to realise that you can do the same thing.
And I mean, talk about that. I mean, we're going to get into your full, we've normally had a break by now, but we're going to get into your full story after the news. But like, just a little glimpse. I mean, you've gone into schools, haven't you? Talking about your experience.
Yeah, in 2018 and 2019, I went into a number of schools, talking about mental illness, addiction. You know, as honestly and as openly as I possibly can. I'm trying to contact the schools again now at the moment to restart that. But you get a great reaction from young children in that. I'm just going to be honest about how I made the mistakes, and you know how what I did and when things went wrong, so that hopefully when their lives hit that same thing, they can think, well, hold up a second, I can make a better choice here, you know, because my mental illness and addiction is, yes, they're both illnesses, but I still think they're both affected by some bad decisions that I made along the way. And again, if you can, you know, you can help people understand that just because you've got a mental ill health doesn't necessarily mean you're mentally ill, you know, and it doesn't have to define you. And sometimes, anyway, you know, having the issues that we have, it makes you a better person because you empathise with people and you care for people. And you know, as I say, I've had people call me a wuss before because I've spoken about going down my mum's and having a cry. I couldn't care less what they think. They, you know, I think I'm a stronger bloke than they are because I'm willing to cry.
I think the key there is as well is trying to get that understanding to the younger that, you know what, it's okay to go down there, or the understanding that it doesn't matter what that person thinks. You know, there's very few people in your life that actually matters what they think about you. And that's good or bad. Mm. You know, you can use social media all day long and get 3 million likes on there. But ultimately, those people, the majority of them, won't know you. So how can they offer an opinion about your life, good or bad? So, you know, you forget about what other people are thinking about you, basically, and just carry on with your day. And if you need to go down to your mum's and have a cry, get down and do it.
Absolutely. You've got to do what you've got to do to get through. And it's that thing, it's that saying, isn't it? Walk a mile in my shoes before you judge me, or something like that. You know, I don't care whether they judge me or not. It doesn't bother me. Their opinion of me, I could not care less. You know, because I know where I am. I know that I've worked hard to try and understand my own issues. I've done quite a bit to help other people as well. So if they've got negative things to say about me, and people still do say negative things about me for my drinking days, that's their problem. I've moved on. You got to believe in yourself in a way. But
people are always going to talk bad about you. I mean, look at John Lennon, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. All these people, what to do was love and get the world together, and every one of them was shot.
Yeah.
So no matter how much good you do, there's always going to be some bloke who don't like you.
Plus, the majority of people are judging you on a single moment. Mm-hmm. Now, but if you think about just today, how many emotions and things you've gone through. So this morning you might have woke up, I'm happy, it's great. So if that person had met you, it'd have been, oh, he's really nice. Mm-hmm. By 20 minutes later, you can be sad and a bit lonely. 30 minutes later, you could have anger. You know, you go through that many different emotions, you're that many different people throughout a day that, you know, it doesn't really matter what anyone thinks because they're just meeting you at the wrong time or the right time.
And I think that's another thing that I've spoke to a lot of people about when they say they get a bit paranoid because somebody's ignored them in the street or something. And I sort of say to them, well, there's no point getting paranoid about that because you don't know what's going on in their lives at that point. And, you know, this person who really upsets me keeps picking on me. And I say, well, that's not very nice, but they, you know, they've got issues themselves. So you have to be able to sort of accept people's issues around you, because you know some of the stuff I've done in the past, I haven't done it on purpose. It's just the way that my life's led, and you know, you have to take into account that other people around you may be having a bad day, and they may, you know, they may have been on a phone or something like that, and just didn't spot you. But again, you have to make you know, other people have bad days, and you have to accept that as well.
But we often figure about that, don't we? We figure about ourselves having a bit of a grump, but someone else having a grump is unacceptable.
Yeah. But everybody's different. We all go through different moods, different days, and you know, you have to be. I think, you know, one of the key words that I use and is acceptance. You know, without acceptance, I don't think you stand a chance.
And accept yourself.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the hardest one to accept, isn't it?
Yeah, one of the things I've said many times over the years when they talk about stigma, the only stigma I've ever really come across is my own stigma against me, you know, because deep down I am a Neanderthal, and I would be, if I hadn't have gone through what I've gone through, I probably would be one of these idiots that say, you know, pull yourself together, have a nice holiday. But, you know, it's you know, you have got to accept, you know, where you are.
Well, Lee, should we go to a couple of songs before the news?
We ain't got time for that, mate. Oh. You're going to have to keep going, Kev.
How long?
We've got another 7 minutes.
Well, in these 7 minutes, what we're going to do, because John, the ex-booze hound, the next segment, because we've normally had a few songs by now, is just a little summary, to keep your balls' interest wet. Yeah. For the... And just tell us a little bit about him. We'll go back over it after the news.
I suppose sort of mental health issues have been in my life for a long time. I mean, from around the age of sort of 15, 16, I started getting depression.
How old, sorry?
About 15, 16. I started drinking when I was 14. I found that drinking gave me a bit more confidence. As a child, I was a very shy child, but I started taking antidepressants when I was about 16, and just sort of went through the motions. As I got older, the drinking got sort of worse and worse, and caused me issues, got me in trouble with the police on a number of occasions. And then sort of carried going, saw different counsellors and different things. And then when I was about 28, 29, I was going through another low period, and I got referred to a counsellor via the GP, and I happened to know a little bit about this counsellor. I knew he had a drug problem himself, and we was talking about my moods and my depression and my anxiety, and eventually I think he sent me to Aquarius originally to try and control my drinking, and I saw that as a bit of a challenge, really, about how much I could get away with, how much I could lie about it in my drink diary. And then we sort of hit this factor that unless I did something about my drinking, I was never going to be able to do anything about my mental health. I was very fortunate that I worked for an insurance company at the time, and I'd got Bupa cover. So in 2003, I ended up in Woodbourne Priory for 28 days. Haven't drunk since. And did okay when I came out of that. Life got a little bit better, but I was still struggling with anxiety and depression, and I was never honest enough with the doctors, because I never wanted to be labelled mentally ill or whatever. And so 10 years after I gave up drinking, I had a mental breakdown. And the weird thing is I didn't want to talk to the GP about. I knew I was more ill than anxiety and depression, but I was never fully honest with the GP because I didn't want that label, and I didn't want. I felt if I had that label, you know, I'd lose my friends, I'd lose my job, I'd lose my house, I'd lose my girlfriend, and all that sort of thing. And then in 2013, when I had the mental breakdown, I lost all that. If I'd have dealt with it better earlier on, you know, things may have been much different. But it's. The reason I had a mental breakdown is because, for me, it was like a fuse went pop in my head. I just tried to be strong for that long that I just couldn't do it anymore. And again, it sort of then sort of turns out that they sort of initially started talking about borderline personality disorder. And then I got another diagnosis of bipolar. You know, I've been on with movement medications around a lot, and I've sort of got myself on a level now.
Because, you know, something that really interests me. You're all right with the label of being an alcoholic, but the thought of being labelled mentally ill, you didn't want that one. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing because I sort of, this is strange, because, again, we are talking, what, 2013. So I don't think there was that much sort of talked about even that short a time ago, and it sort of, again, like I say, for some reason I knew I wasn't just anxious and depressed. I knew there was more, but I just, it scared me that I didn't want to be, you know, mentally ill. And from memory, I don't think we ever really talked about mental illness until I had the mental breakdown, and then after that, it started. That seemed to be the first time we were talking about it. I don't particularly like the label of alcoholic, but it is what I am. As I call myself, a mentally ill retired alcoholic. People used to get upset that I couldn't call myself an alcoholic anymore if I hadn't had a drink for 10 years. So I changed it. You know, I'm a retired alcoholic. Who knows? I might come out of retirement one day, but hopefully
don't call it a comeback.
But hopefully not. But again, you know, it's that sort of thing about labels and things like that. You know, I've just mentioned a couple of diagnoses that I got there, but it doesn't really matter what the diagnosis is, because a lot of mental illnesses, anywhere, you know, going from anxiety or borderline personality disorder or someone with paranoid schizophrenia.
Sorry to cut in there, John, but we do have to go to the news now.
Okay.
But we'll hear more of it after the news in a couple of songs.
Now with your local news, I'm Mike Kelly. A hospital care worker from Smethwick who stole bank cards from a dying man has been jailed for 9 months. 49-year-old Rebecca Ellis stole 2 debit cards from cancer patient Fred Bromley when he was admitted to the QE hospital in Birmingham on the 20th of February 2020. She then used the cards to go on a spending spree while her victim lay terminally ill in hospital. Ellis denied theft and fraud but was found guilty at Birmingham Magistrates Court. She was sentenced yesterday at the city's Crown Court. Mr. Bromley, a former police inspector, passed away not long after the offences had taken place. Police want to trace the driver of a white Range Rover that was involved in a hit and run in Dudley that left a 12-year-old girl with serious injuries. The girl was struck by the vehicle at around 7:20 p.m. on August the 24th in Starbridge Road. The car then drove off, leaving the youngster seriously injured at the roadside. She was taken to hospital and has since been recovering at home. Officers say the Range Rover has been identified as a cloned vehicle that was using registration FJ63HZV at the time of the hit and run. A fire which caused thousands of pounds worth of damages to crops in Kidderminster is thought to have been started deliberately. Police have launched an appeal following the blaze, which was started after hay bales were allegedly set alight on farmland off Haberley Lane on Sunday, September the 19th. Witnesses described seeing 2 youths on bikes, with one wearing black and one in grey, as well as one female wearing a grey hooded top and grey shorts in the area shortly prior to the start of the fire. Voluntary and community groups in the Dudley Borough can now apply for funding of up to £499 to provide social activities for disabled children and their families. The money is part of a £40,000 pot to help children with disabilities enjoy activities outside of school hours. The funding is available from Dudley Council through the Small Bids programme as part of the Short Break service. That's the latest. Small and Mine at blackcountryradio.co.uk.
Had a great 7-year white knuckle ride, killing time, flying high as I held on tight to you. To you. Did I blow my mind on the wild side, singing hallelujah to him every night with you. With you. And I'm not gonna lie, say I've been alright, 'cause it feels like I've been living upside down. What can I say? I'm surviving, calling out these sheets to see another day. What can I say? I'm surviving, and I'm gonna be fine, I'm gonna be fine, I think I'll be fine. Like a thundercloud in November rain, is the black dog out running wild again for you? For you. Trying to stream my way to a better life, but a daydream crash like vanilla sky. Do you? Do you? 'Cause I'm not gonna lie and say I've been alright, 'cause it feels like I've been living upside down. What can I say? I'm surviving, calling out these sheets to see another day. What can I say? I'm surviving, and I'm gonna be fine, I'm gonna be fine, I think I'll be fine. Be fine, I'm gonna be fine, I think I'll be fine. I've got to be near you every night.
It's the Black Country Blokes on Black Country Extra, talking to John, the ex-alcoholic hound.
Ex-booze hound.
Booze hound. See, I can't forget your nickname, right? But, briefly before we went to our break, it was, he was saying he, at 16, went on antidepressants.
Antidepressants, yeah.
Started drinking, and it's been on and off, on and off. And the thing that really amazed me about it was, like, he went to rehab, and we're going to talk about rehab in a bit, but he wasn't happy to have the title of an alcoholic. But he was almost ashamed of having the title of mental health. And I think back at the 90s, early 2000s, and even to this day, there's almost a stigma as, like, the loony, or we're frightened if we're given that, like, if it's cancer, oh, it's cancer, oh, I'm sorry, oh, let me bring you some grapes. But if you're mentally unwell, people don't always know how to address it. And am I going to lose my status as a man? Am I going to lose my social liberties? And isn't it backwards how we could accept one title but not another?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's sort of, I don't mind any title now, you know. Say it's when I started doing the blogs.
What's the name of the blog?
The blog is just www.xboozound.co.uk. And earlier on, I used probably an unpolitically correct word, as in mentalists and normals. And throughout my early blogging days, I used the word lunatic, you know, nut job, mad. I mean, if you actually look in the dictionary, the actual definition of mad, it actually talks about having mental health issues. So it's factually correct. For me, the reason I did that is, It's a weird conversation, but I used to work with two gay guys, and they was always, you know, behind the scenes calling themselves each other names that I was sitting there thinking, well, I'm not allowed to say those words. And I said, why do you use those phrases? And they say, well, that's what we get called anyway. So what we did is we took them back and we used them, and they can't hurt us anymore. So I felt that way with words like lunatic. And I mean, it's a funny word, isn't it? It's not a great politically correct word, but it's, you know, lunatic, nut job, mad. Mad as a bucket of fish, you know, it doesn't really matter. But again, I think people get far too tied up in using the right words. So it's like, you know, I've been to meetings where we've had discussions on, should we call it mental health? Should we call it mental ill health? Should we call it mental illness? Should we call you users, or should we call you service users or patients? And people get so caught up in the getting the word right that it's just a waste of time, because we all know what it means. As I say, I quite often I talk about the fact that there's a hell of a difference in my mind between mental well-being and mental illness. There needs to be a definition made between those two. You know, the people who are going through poor mental well-being at the moment because of COVID, that may think they're going onto the path of mental illness, but it's a separate thing. It's not a diagnosable thing. I can't remember what the question was.
But as you said there, like, as we met earlier, it's like, as an alcoholic, you go, I'm an addict. And then people go, you're not an addict because you're not a druggie. But I'm an addict, as in I am addicted. Addicted.
Yeah. It's you know, it is. It's I suppose alcoholic is actually, you know, it's more of a pleasant term than addict, I suppose. And I think a lot of alcoholics do seem to get the they do seem to get upset when they're put in the same bracket as well, they're druggies. I only drink too much. Well, at the end of the day, it's the same thing. You know, you've got an addiction and it's messing with your life. It doesn't matter what your drug of choice is. It's messing with your life. It's just finished making people's lives around you like hell. So it doesn't really matter. But I think people sometimes have to soften the blow sometimes from the sales when, you know, at the end of the day, you're an addict, whether you're down the bookies every day or
it's just to make yourself feel better. I'm an alky, but at least I'm not a druggie, or at least I'm not a, you know, I get drunk on cider, but I'm not on that vodka. It's a way of going, I know I'm bad, but he's worse.
I'm not an alcoholic because I don't sleep on a park bench, you know. And I still think there's people still to this day that don't think you're an alcoholic unless you're homeless and you know, drinking the amount of functioning alcoholics out there, really successful, you know, wealthy business people that are alcoholics and addicts is ridiculous. But again, it's whether you're functioning with it and I think there's a fine line between being an alcoholic and being dependent, you know, on that substance. And again, it's wrong to be dependent on alcohol, but it's okay to be dependent on going to the gym, or it's okay on be dependent of watching Coronation Street. I know this is utter nonsense, but, you know, people have different dependencies in their lives, and it's whether that dependency is affecting your life negatively. I don't think somebody who drinks every day, if it's not affecting their life negatively, what's wrong with that?
Well, we've talked about this, Lee, haven't we? Like people can be addicted to exercise. Mm-hmm. And you've openly said, haven't you, Lee, some days if you haven't done your run, or you haven't, you can be all right, so-and-so, can't you?
I've questioned myself about alcohol, because I can go months and months and months, years, without drinking. But when I'm drinking absolutely every single night, and I'm drinking 8 cans, 10 cans, and it doesn't affect me. You know, I'm not getting drunk on it, and I'll do it night after night after night. I always thought to myself, well, where does that line come? Where does that, okay, you're an alcoholic, and I feel like I need a drink the next day. But then when my mind is in the right place, and I go, actually, I'm not going to have a drink, I'll go ages without having a drink. So, are you an alcoholic? It's a blurred line, isn't it, to where you're at? And I think the description you just give of, does it affect your daily life? And I think that's probably the key to it.
Does it affect your life negatively? There's a survey that I did years ago, and you know, there's some answers, and literally anybody who takes that survey, they will say, well, you're an alcoholic, because it's that, but, you know, and again, there's people that think, well, I'm not an alcoholic because I can take 3 months off. Yeah, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not an alcoholic, because you're making an effort to stop doing something which people come and go from easily.
Yeah, and it's also, I also thought about that myself. I thought, well, if I went to the doctors and says, well, I'm drinking 8 to 10 cans a night, he'd go, well, you know, you've got a problem there. Well, you shouldn't be drinking that amount, you know. So it is, and it's, yeah, that's been helpful, that I can go, actually, it's probably not, because it didn't negatively affect my life.
There's a fine line, isn't there? I think there really is a fine line. And as I say, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there that do have a drink every day, but that doesn't mean they're an alcoholic. You know, as I say, I think for me, you know, if it is affecting your life negatively, and it's causing you grief, then you know, and you probably know that you need to do something about it. But then the problem is a lot of people know they need to do something about it, but very often don't. And one of the things that I see a lot of is that, obviously, these days, because alcoholism is accepted as an illness, which it is, without a shadow of a doubt, people then use that to allow themselves to carry on drinking further. And that that bothers me a little bit, because it's like, you know, if you've got a an upset stomach, you wouldn't let that go on for 3 weeks. You'd do something about it, you know, using the fact that that alcoholism is an illness. That is part of the lies you tell yourself to allow you to keep moving on. You know it's an illness, you've got to do something about it, because ultimately, in the end of the day, you let it go on and on and on, it's going to kill you eventually.
And I think it kind of goes back to Kev's original question, because I kind of go, okay, I'm stopping alcohol and I'm going training now. I'm going to work out hard, and then I have days now where I won't take a break, because I have to train, you know what I mean? And that goes into my head. But then you go, well, if alcohol is an illness, then is that an illness?
Yeah.
You know, where do you draw the line again with doing it?
Well, I think in a way, isn't it right that if you do train every day, you are damaging your body, basically? Don't you have to have a break during...
Well, rest, we always need rest, don't we? A bit of rest. But as you say, when you're fighting through the pain and... As you say, sometimes you're messing yourself up more than you're actually bettering yourself, but that's part of an addictive personality, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether it's fags, drugs, gambling, alcohol, if you've got that little thing, well, every paycheck I've got to buy myself some new trainers every time, it creates that little monkey on your back, doesn't it?
Yeah, I suppose weirdly, I'm wearing Adidas Samba. I've got 13 pairs of them. So I've got a little bit of OCD kicking in there somewhere. But I think, you know, again, with the training, I would imagine at some point through the training you get a buzz from it. Are you addicted to the buzz that you get from the training? But then I would imagine it's probably better to be addicted to training than it is to drugs or booze. But it's a dependence, still a dependency, isn't it?
I think it's better in the terms of short term, but long term potentially not.
And it's when it starts affecting relationships, because unless you're competing to box or competing a muscle man competition, and when it starts affecting relationships, well, come on, we're having a day out, we're having a family day out, or we're going out for a meal. No, I can't. And when you fixate on nothing else but that, once again, if it starts affecting your relationships, then it's a problem.
I guess if it becomes an obsession, you know, is it a need or is it a real obsession? And again, I think I would say if it goes into obsession that you must go to the gym every day, then that's going to be affecting your life negatively, isn't it? You know, maybe not your life, but your loved ones around you that need you in their lives as well.
But with alcohol dependency, because we had Sean Griffiths on the show, and he works with drink and drugs. And when you're dependent on alcohol and you have to drink every day, you can't just cold turkey, can you? Because then your body goes into shock. And people think like the heroines and the crack cocaines, when you can go cold turkey, and it's not going to be pleasant with heroin. But alcohol, if you just stop it on the head, it can be fatal, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was... I tell this as a funny story, but it's not really. But before I went into Woodbourne Priory, my doctor said to me, you cannot give up drinking before you go in on. And I thought that was amazing that my GP was telling me I've got to carry on drinking. But yeah, absolutely. You know, you do... Whenever I'm helping people with the booze, I very, very rarely say to them, you must stop drinking, because that's not my choice. But what I will do with them is help bring that amount down to a certain extent. And sometimes they either go, oh, well, I'll just do it cold turkey. And I'm like, well, you're probably best not to do that, because you can have a heart attack or
seizures
and things like that. And you know, when I went into the booze clinic, it was obviously I stopped straight away. I think the night before I went in, I had 3 bottles of wine and 8 cans of Stella,
tide you over.
I thought, right, if it's going to be the last one, I'm going to give it a good go. And I remember my mum took me to the Priory, and when they were sort of searching my bags to make sure I got no booze or stuff in there, they were asking what I had to drink the night before, and I was, you know, I was stone cold sober. And when I said 3 bottles of wine and 8 cans of Stella, my mum sort of nearly fell off a chair. But it's it's going into the booze clinic, you do stop straight away, but they give you medication to control that. and so you don't get the shakes and the DTs and things like that. So they withdraw you in the right way, so you don't have the seizures and stuff.
Would you tell us a bit about the detox centre?
Yeah, yeah. I call it the booze clinic, but it was the Woodbourne Priory in Birmingham. It was private. I was fortunate that I was in Bupa. It's a 28-day stay, and I think it's for that 28-day, if you have to pay for it yourself, something like $15,000. So
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a nice place, and I was very fortunate that I was in Bupa. Part of the reason that I chose to go in was that I felt that, you know, I was fortunate to have the option of doing this. And if I didn't take that option, then I was sort of almost taking the mick out of people who didn't have that option. So I felt it felt as if it was something I had to do to go in there. And if I'm honest, you know, a part of me went in there because I wanted to come out and people would say how brave I was and how strong I was and get people off my back. I never really believed that I would come out sober. I don't think there's any one single person that I knew at the time that would have put money on me coming out there sober. There's just nobody would believe that would be the case, and as I say it that way, in that, you know, literally if I can do it, then you can do it too. I realised I was very lucky. I was fortunate that I got the option of the 28-day in the Woodbourne probably because of Bupa. I honestly don't think I could have done it through AA and other things. I think that the fact that you're sort of taken out of life, out of reality for the 28 days helps. While I was in there for the first 2 weeks, we weren't allowed out, and we were allowed visitors. Everybody else had visitors, and I decided I didn't want visitors. I just wanted to concentrate on what was going on. And I think to begin with, I really struggled with it because it was all based around the 12 steps, which is they call it the big book, big blue book. And it was written by a doctor and a vicar. And the 12 steps are all based around God is used. The word God is used an awful lot. And I'm not a big believer. So I struggled with that, and I just sort of lied and manipulated my way through. We had sort of classes and sort of we had conversations and discussions, and we worked through the 12 steps, and I was just sort of going through, and you knew that I could tell that out of the five or six of us that were there, you could see people were looking at me as if to say, he's never going to get it, you know, and everybody else was going to be okay. And as it turns out, I think I was the only one that stayed sober. But the point that I got it, and I still don't know what it is, was we had to write our story with booze and how it had affected us and what it did for us. And we had to sit in a circle, and we had to read our stories out to our fellow patients, or whatever you want to call them. And we all sort of, oh, that was brave. That was really powerful, John. And well done for writing that. And the guy who was running it, a guy called Chris, basically said that was neither honest, brave, nor strong. He said, you've just done exactly what you've done for the last 2 weeks. You've told us what you know we want to hear. You've manipulated the situation. Manipulation is something that you are very good at. If you're an alcoholic, you have to be. And after a bit of a raised discussion, at the age of 30, I was sent out of the room like a little naughty boy to think about my reaction to that. And when I stood out there spitting feathers, I sort of thought, you know what, he's right. I haven't took this seriously at all. I've just coasted. I don't believe in it. But I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it, and I'm going to get it. I don't think I can get it the way they want me to because of the God thing. But I am going to get it, and the way I got it really is I can never remember the word, all the words, but the first step of the 12 steps is we admit to ourselves we became powerless against alcohol. So it's sort of me saying to myself that, you know, I cannot control alcohol, so I have to avoid a drink. And that's the way I'm going to get it. And it's one of the main reasons I think I'm still sober is that I'm a bit of a stubborn so and so. There's another word I could use, but not on radio. But the I'm stubborn, and I wanted. I'm like, you, those demons, you're not going to beat me, you know. And again, I think strangely that stubbornness is also something that's kept me alive, because, you know, through the years I've thought about suicide and things like that. But a few years ago it just came to me that, you know, I'm not going to let those demons beat me, and no matter how bad it gets, or, you know, how close I get, I'm never going to give them the satisfaction that they beat me. So stubbornness has taken me a long way. I was very lucky to get into a clinic. I do realise that, but I know from working with other people that it is doable. It's blooming hard, but it's definitely worth doing.
But once you cleaned yourself, you'd done this, and then how many years was it later? Because you said love from the edge, love. 15, you'd suffer with some form of mental health. But then how many years later, after being sober, did you have your breakdown?
10 years. It's weird, actually, because, as I say, like I mentioned earlier, I got those dates tattooed on me, 1973 when I was born, 2003 when I got sober, and 2013 when I had the mental breakdown. And the problem was, really, we dealt with the alcohol. We got that alcohol out of my system. But we never really dealt properly with the mental health, so I just went on for, you know, 10 further years still not being massively upfront with the GP, still not wanting to go down that route. So in a way I was, you know, I was on the wrong medication for a long time.
They keep blaming the booze.
I think these days They seem to have this thing that they won't even try to help your mental health unless you do you sort your booze thing out first. I think that's a cop out. I think you can do it the same together, but it's understandable because booze and mental illness to me is I think whether people agree with this or not, it doesn't really matter. I was born with it in me. I was born with the addict in me. I was born with the mental health issues in me, and they just came out because they're meant to. And you know, I know a lot of people won't agree with that, and that's fine. But you know, I've got, you know, people always talk about the traumas that set off their mental health issues and stuff like that. I had no traumas. I had no, you know, I had no issues. I had. You know, I had a decent childhood, and it just came about. And sometimes it's just in you. You know,
it's a bit like cancer, isn't it?
I suppose you're prone to it, or you can be prone to it. And you know, and again, you know, if mental illness is you know a chemical imbalance in the head, I'm guessing the booze didn't help. You know, but it's. It's two sides of one coin, really, for me. It's
chicken and the egg.
Yeah, what came first?
Sometimes you can do everything right.
Absolutely.
You might have never touched a drink, gone to Sunday school, and an avid gardener, and then boom. And it's like, you know, these poor so-and-sos who triathletes or boxers, they've never smoked, drank, and a bump, cancer gets them. Yep. It's the same kind of thing, isn't it? Yep. But instead of being a lump, it's a blip.
Well, I think it's a strange one. You know, again, I think sometimes people frown upon the fact when you use cancer in the same sentence as mental illness, because you know they see cancer obviously as an illness that can kill you, but mental illness can do the same. And I think sometimes it's not a bad comparison to have, because with cancer there's the word the C word, and there's a huge umbrella, and underneath that umbrella there are, you know, very mild cancers that can be dealt with very quickly, very aggressive cancers that can take you straight away. Mental illness is actually the same. Mental health is the same. There's a huge umbrella that underneath it, you know, your anxiety. If you don't deal with your anxiety, you can end up with your panic attacks. If you don't deal with those, you can end up with, you know, depression. If you don't deal with that, you can go down the PTSD. And before you know it, you know, you're a full-blown mentalist, because you've never challenged or you've never done anything positive towards trying to make a difference to your life.
And the key is to catch them both early.
Yeah.
Just make sure you know. But, I mean, with mental health, a lot of it isn't caught early because it's aerosol. Like, if you find a lump, the majority of people are going straight up to the doctor and getting it checked out. The same doesn't happen with mental health. You know when you're going down that road, your mind starts playing things over. You know you're at that point where you should be seeking help or talking or doing whatever you need to do, but you don't do it because of the stigma around it.
Yeah. I think, again, stigma, this is the first time I've mentioned it, but I've written a book called The A to Z Guide of Navigating Mental Illness, Addiction and Associated Issues, and I can't actually read the words that I put for the subject of stigma. And it just on the one page, it says S for stigma. Stigma, something stigma. Stigma will always exist. Get over it. That's stigma covered. Now on to T. You know, stigma's always going to be there. There's always going to be some stigma attached to it. I don't care. It's mad to allow this stigma to stop you, you know, doing something. It's an illness, and again, you know, again, if it's a chemical imbalance in your brain, then what we need to do really is just get rid of two words. We need to get rid of physical, and we need to get rid of mental. Because as far as I'm concerned, if it's a chemical imbalance in your head, that is a physical illness, isn't it? Because, you know, unless I'm different to most people, my head is connected to my body via my neck, and that makes it a physical illness. And again, it's that thing about, you know, is addiction, drugs. If your choice of drug is coke, you snort that up your nose. That's physically going into your body, and it's physically having an effect on your makeup. You know, so We always have to class things as mental and physical, but what we need to do is think of it as an illness, just as an illness.
Is he well or is he poorly?
Is he well or is he poorly? Because I know a lot of people who, one of my mates who died a few years ago, I still believe to this day that basically the NHS killed him. Probably shouldn't say that, but I've said it now. Because he'd got mental illness problems, and as an ex-rugby player, he'd got an awful lot of pain issues, and he basically just, they could not get together, the physical and the mental side could not get together and treat him as an individual and work together. So they were always moving this medication round, that medication round. You know, we've got to treat people as individuals and treat them, their situation, not just label them with you're mentally ill, you're physically ill. We have to have a complete sort of change, and they always used to talk quite a while back. They were always talking about getting the same parity of esteem for mental health and physical health, and I used to laugh at that because the physical health isn't particularly going well anyway. So why would we want parity of esteem? That's something that's not working. But the system's so broken at the moment that people have got to find another way of treating themselves in a way, and part of that is owning the illness that you have. And one of the things I've wrote a long time back was, you know, in order to move forward with your recovery, you have to own your own illness. But more importantly, you have to own your own recovery. There's not a single person out there that's going to fix you. Not one single thing is going to fix you. But if you put together a combination of things and work hard and dedicate yourself to moving forward, then you can get better.
Recovery is a lot like education, isn't it? Some people are going to be seers, heroes or doers. Some people are going to need medicine. Some people are going to have talking therapy. Some people have got to be active. And free people won't necessarily be treated the same. Some people will need to be occupied. Some people need medication. Some people have to talk it out. And maybe that's the way we've got to go. As you said, treated as an individual. I mean, what helped you mainly? Was it the talking therapies or was it more isolation of getting away from it?
I don't really know, to be fair. I think it was, again, perhaps stubbornness was one of the things. It was a case of, I sort of, like I say, when I was in there, after I'd had that argument with Chris about me lying and manipulating it, I used this phrase that I got it, and I still don't know what it is. But I knew that I had to change, and I knew I had to put some effort into that. And you know, quite honestly, if I hadn't done that back in 2003, you know, I'd be dead. You know, simple as that by now. You know, and I know a lot, you know, quite a number of people that, you know, my age and younger that have drunk themselves to death or drugged themselves to death, and you know, it's not. It's not as if it's happening a lot these days and it's getting worse. I don't really know what it was that sort of made me get it, but I think it's almost a change of attitude. Okay, this thing could destroy me, or these things could destroy me. Am I going to let it destroy me, or am I going to do something about it? And it's that fighting back, isn't it? You know, like you train boxers. If you put a boxer in a ring and he stood there and let someone punch him around the head, left, right, and centre, he ain't going to win that battle, is he? No. And you know, you have to find a way to fight against the demons that drive you in the wrong direction.
I mean, when you got here, you showed me your phone. You still got your phone? When you showed me some of the statistics before.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and this is, once again, statistics only tell part of the truth because we'll never know the full story because we don't talk to everybody. But these were like from 2017, 18. So these aren't even like 2019 and 20, 21, I believe. And who knows how bad the statistics are going to be for the last 18 months of lockdown.
Yeah, I put together, I'm a blogger, a page called A Picture is Worth a Thousand Words. And there's some things that I've created. There's a thing that says them and us doesn't work. When I was starting out with the blogs, I was angry, I was shouting, and then realised that in order to make any change that we've actually got to work with the system.
Yes.
Another thing that says, they say the hardest thing to do is ask for help. They're wrong. The hardest thing to do is ask for help and actually receive nothing, which is what's happening, you know, so much today. And one I found on the internet is the most dangerous phrase in the language is "we've always done it this way." Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the problem that we've got with the NHS and adult social care these days. When you look at the figures, so I've got a picture here. How many care worker vacancies are there at the moment? 112,000. How are they going to run a system if there's got 112,000 positions vacant?
Is that in the care industry?
In the care industry, yeah. Number of people on England's NHS waiting list tops 5 million for the first time. Two-fifths of patients waiting for mental health treatment forced to resort to emergency or crisis care. Let's have a look, what's the next one?
But you know that, and to be a care worker, you've got to be a special kind of person. I mean, yep. Leah talked about this. In fact, last week when we had Vicky on, Kerry's care assistant, and said you can get more money stacking the shelves at a supermarket than you can being as a remarkable human being who's cleaning someone, caring for them, giving drugs. You are their life support machine to keep them alive and to keep them well and happy and to make more money stacking shelves.
You wonder why people do it, don't you? I mean, I was talking
angels,
to
angels. Yeah,
I was talking to a carer the other day, and you know, she gets paid £9 an hour, and she could earn a lot more than that elsewhere. But she says she does it because she's a caring person. One of the things that I think perhaps will come out of this COVID situation is that there's more talk about carers now, and there's more talk about social care, there's more talk about how it's needed. Somebody said to me the other day that 80% of healthcare is outside the NHS. You know, and there's so many unpaid carers out there. And I don't want to get political, but obviously a couple of weeks ago, Boris let the whole system down with his social care increase in money, which the NHS is going to get first. Anyway, let's move on from that. But carers allow people to live lives and not just exist, you know, because I think that's what seems to be okay for, you know, as long as people are okay to exist. But carers give so much time that we really need to be rewarding them a lot better.
To me, John, as most people know, my youngest is severely disabled, and I'm very lucky that my mum is one of her carers. She's been... Her job since she left school was caring for people with disabilities. There was no one better. But I look at what she actually does, and it's akin to what a nurse does. The responsibility of drawing up medicine and giving medicines, that, you know, the changing of nappies, the changing of beds, the lifting, the carrying, it's on par with what a nurse does. But then... they're not viewed the same in society, and you know, it's, don't get me wrong, nurses do an absolutely fantastic job. I'm not having a go at nurses whatsoever, you know, but I think that bridge needs to be you know, it needs to be equals.
Absolutely. I mean, as your mum is a carer, is that an unpaid carer?
That's a paid carer.
That's a paid
we're
carer.
Lucky that she's paid.
It's they are, they're just undervalued, simple as that, aren't they? They're undervalued, and as I say, if we've got 112,000 vacancies out there within social care for carers, how will we got any chance of having a system that's gonna help? And you go, you know, with your daughter, you know, she needs that care to give her any chance of having, you know, being able to live a life. You know, I think people sometimes think it's as long as they can exist, that's all right. That's not what it's about. And I was talking to a carer the other day, and she sort of said, well, if I did everything that by the health and safety, I would never be able to do anything for them. And I think these days carers, they should be left to care with their heart, which is where that's why they do their job.
So but you've got 3 minutes with Kev, then you've got 2.5 minutes with John.
Yeah,
let me just put a bit of lippy on her. Mm. Or let me, she's with us now, so...
Yeah.
What did your husband do?
Yeah.
Oh, you're looking a bit flushed, let me put a bit of lippy on.
But it also goes back. I mean, the trust that parents, like I say, my youngest being disabled, the trust we have to put into carers and teachers and assistants. And I often think, because we have more hours that we can use to get more carers in. But, you know, we've advertised for jobs. We haven't had money come through. The ones who have come through, I think, I think you're just going for any job that's available, not the one. And then I think, well, you're trying to get someone for £9 an hour.
Mm.
What you're really going to get?
Yep.
As I say, you can go to a supermarket and earn more than £9 an hour now. So what you're really going to get? You're not going to get someone who is, or you're going to be very lucky to find someone who does care.
Well, when we had Vicky on last week, and I said, Vicky, what a bit of advice would you give to someone who wants to be a carer? She went, don't do it because you're bored of your job. You've got to do it because you're a caring soul. And I think people, we all fall into jobs that we may or may not like, but to do something where you are an angel on planet Earth who cares and who goes the extra mile for, you know, you can't do because you're bored of sitting around watching Jeremy Kyle. You've got to do any kind of jobs because you love it.
And again, you know, I think like you just said, you know, it's nurses are amazing creatures as well. They're angels themselves. The crime is the fact that the carers are so undervalued, and you know, and again, you've seen these stories, haven't you, about people who work within the in the homes while COVID's been going on. They've been sort of away from their families, caring and going that extra mile, and you know, those are the sort of people that we need in the care industry. And again, when they're talking to, you know, someone might have dementia, but that doesn't necessarily mean they don't get the anxiety and depression at the same time. So I think the other thing with regard to care and social care, their model has been for so many years that they work with the person rather than with the illness.
Yes.
And that's now the way the NHS say they want to work. But the social care have been working like that for many, many years. And, you know, they should be allowed to care with their hearts rather than their heads. And I think they're living like a lot of us do, and we have done for a long time. It's cover our backsides at all cost. And they should be able to, you know, just actually asking a question, how are you, and spending that time to listen to the answer could make all the difference. And that doesn't cost money, does it?
And I have to think that, like, we've, as you just said, like, putting a bit of lippy on or giving them a shave or making that patient feel like a human being doesn't cost any more money, but it makes them feel like a person, the person they once were, or that person that's been lost with illness. And as you say, that don't cost any more.
It's having that consistency as well, isn't it? Having the same person coming, you know. It's you know, if you're unwell, whatever form of unwell you are, you know, you're vulnerable at times, aren't you? And new faces and different faces coming in left, right, and centre is not going to help you. And I think it's you know, again, I think it's, you know, if again working with social care and we have to look at the whole picture. We have to look at the person and work with them. You know, it's really important. And, you know, otherwise we just get stuck and going round and round in circles trying to fix problems that are unfixable.
But hopefully by having this voice and having people on like yourself and like Kerry and Vicky and all that, Debbie from Blackwood Room said, by having these people on, hopefully this gets a conversation started, be it any kind of being poorly, or any kind of wellness, or any kind of organisation. If we start talking about it, more people talk about it, hopefully change will come.
It's one of those things, isn't it? You know, it's when I started the blog, you know, I did this little piece that said about me and blah blah blah, and I sort of said if it end up helping one person, then it'll be worth it. So if there's anything that any of us guys have said tonight that makes just one guy say, look, you know, I've been struggling with something, I think I should go and see my GP or do something, then it's worth doing it. You know, and again, I don't know whether to end on a bad statistic, but you know, it's really important that men, you do, you know, find a way to talk about your mental health or your addiction, and it's really important. And the reason it's really important, you've just got to look at the statistics of, I'm going to say it's a negative, suicides, but we need to talk about this subject. It needs to be talked about. In 2019, 5,691 people in England and Wales took their own lives. 4,303 of them were men, at 75%. And in 2018, 5,420. And again, exactly 75% of them were males, 4,097. That is a horrible statistic, but it's a statistic that gives you a base that says that we're getting something wrong at the moment. And if there's that many men taking their own lives, we need to speak even if it's your brother might take the mickey out of you, it doesn't matter, but you can have a laugh about it. But as soon as you've brought that subject up and you start to learn how to talk about it, then your recovery can begin.
And if you mention suicide, if I go, John, I know all jokes and stuff, are you suicidal? John's not then going to go, I wasn't, but I am now. That it will never happen.
No.
But by me addressing it, John, you go, thank you for mentioning. You know what I mean?
Yep.
He might brush off, go, don't be saft, Kev. Or he might go, you know what, Kev? I'm glad you've noticed. Because by me noticing, might stop John from actually doing it.
I think it is. I say it's not a great subject to end on because you don't want it to be negative. But I'm trying to do it in a positive way. And the fact that it's a no go conversation area, isn't it? You don't go there, but we need to go there because, you know, at the end of the day, asking that question, you know, you look a bit down today, John. Are you all right? Are you got suicidal thoughts? Just that question in itself could allow me to then talk to you about it and maybe talk to somebody else about it. And, you know, if you're talking about it, you're getting it out of your system and hopefully it will stop people doing it. You know, it's
that conversation might have just saved a life.
Yeah, it's important that there's no such thing as a no-go area, and I've always said that I would answer any question anybody ever asked me on this, in these subjects, because I've got nothing to be afraid of, got nothing to be ashamed of. And the hashtag I use on social media, it's a long one, but it's mentally ill, no shame whatsoever.
How can people find you on social media?
Social media, it's all ex-boozehound, ExBoozeHound. I'm on Twitter. I do vlogs on YouTube at ExBoozeHound. My blog, which I don't do a lot of writing anymore, but it's still there at www.exboozehound.co.uk. You know, literally, if you type in John Mansell without the H, it's actually Jonathan, but we don't talk about that too often.
I get called Kevin when I'm being told off.
That's it, my mum. Yeah, my mum tells me off. Yeah, so I always say it's J-O when I'm too cool for the H. But it's, yeah, John Mansell, or you type in ex-boozehound, you'll find me.
And it's brilliant having people on because, once again, it's experience. And by talking about experience, no matter what that experience is, we can fight it together, guys.
Yep, talking about stuff that makes sense to other people and making sure they don't feel isolated, making sure they realise that it's not only them that it's happening to. And, you know, sometimes the oddest things that we say, they may think, oh, yeah, I've thought like that. Mm-hmm. Bang, you've done some good and you can move forward.
So, John, we're almost at the end now. We've got a few more minutes, but I'll ask you now, have you any quotes or sayings that have helped you get through life over the years?
Yes, I've got one tattooed on my arm. It's my own motto that I came up with, which is enjoy the good and ride out the bad. And that came from realising that with mental health issues or mental illness, you know the bad times are going to come. So what you need to do is when the good times are there, enjoy them. Another one that I use all the time is, it is what it is. It's just easy that way. There's many others, but some of them are probably not for air. So I'll probably leave it there.
I kind of feel like we've kind of skipped over when your mental health problem started. So I think we definitely need you on again.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'll be back.
And you can always find us on our YouTube, on any good podcast platform, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and everywhere in between. John, my brother, thank you ever so much for coming.
My pleasure, mate. Cheers, guys.
So, guys, I hope you've enjoyed it. So until we see each other next time, take care of yourselves and each other. Ta-ra, a bit.